WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. The military has established tight press controls during the Gulf War that are very controversial among journalists. My guest David Halberstam won a Pulitzer Prize for his reporting on the early days of the Vietnam War for the New York Times. He was one of the first journalists to challenge the upbeat picture of the Vietnam War that the American government was presenting to the public. Halberstam also wrote about the war in his book The Making of a Quagmire, and he wrote about the rise of media giants in his book The Powers That Be. Halberstam's new book, The Next Century, is about the end of the American century, the century of American dominance. It picks up where his previous book, The Reckoning, left off. The Reckoning compared the American and Japanese auto industries, analyzing how the Japanese had surpassed us. Well, before we talked about the next century, I asked Halberstam what he thought of the military restrictions of the press during the Gulf War.
Well, I think obviously from the very beginning there's been an attempt to control the news of the war. I think we live in a wired world, and on both sides, on all sides now, I mean, the importance of television is becoming clearer all the time in terms of government process. It was sort of, I suppose, the last lesson of the Vietnam War. I think the military has, and the administration has, misread the Vietnam War. I think there is a sort of post-Vietnam belief that the press coverage hurt the military and cost us what would have otherwise have been a war that we would have won there. I think that's, as Barry Zorthian, the former chief press officer of the American Embassy in Saigon, pointed out on Nightline one night, that is a canard, that what got us into trouble in Vietnam was not a bad press corps, but a bad policy. But I think there's been a belief that they have got to control the press, and I think so much of this struggle has been over, is really not about print, it's not about even radio, it is about television and about who owns or who deploys the cameras.
Why do you think it's television that the military is most concerned about?
Well, because I think pictures are enormously dramatic, because they are afraid of two things from the pictures. One, the impact, I suppose, of pictures of the devastation we might cause to the Iraqis or to Iraqi civilians, the impact of that on people in other parts of the Arab world or in the Third World or even in Europe. And they are equally uneasy about pictures of casualties, as of American casualties shown to the American people. I mean, I think there is an instinct to want to control events and to control perceptions of events. That's part of, I suppose, a normal struggle in a democracy, but it's made all the more powerful because we live, you know, in the Vietnam War, we didn't have satellites. When I was a young reporter there, let's go back slightly in time. I mean, television reporters were a minor presence in 1962 and 63. They were a couple guys who were former UPI reporters, one of them Peter Kalischer, who lived in Hong Kong, came over periodically, went around like print reporters, sent their film back to Hong Kong from whence it was shipped to the United States, where it vied for time on a 15-minute news show that was done in black and white. Well, gradually the pace picked up and it was soon done in color. But even by the end of the Vietnam War, it was not done by satellite. I think the immediacy of satellite is a new dimension. And the other thing is, I must say, as someone who's critical of network television, that I think that networks have earned some of this criticism and this lack of trust, that they have been so obsessed with dramatic footage, with footage that has action news. They so little deign to cover ordinary foreign policy, foreign events, which show small incremental change, that they have really created among other people, working reporters such as myself, a belief that they are essentially isolationist, that they really don't care about serious of foreign news. They care about impact and about ratings. And that as the quality of the technology has gone up, the quality of the editing capacity, the ability to balance the visual with the non-visual, has gone down. So I don't have great admiration for the people. I don't have quite the respect for the networks I used to. I mean, I have great respect for network journalists like Garrett Gutley or Charles Corral, people like that. But I mean, the 22-minute news hole is utterly inadequate, and I don't really believe that they're as serious as they should be. Think of how little they did in the way of covering the rise of Saddam Hussein. Think of what a poor job they did in covering the Iran-Iraq war. Think of the frenzy they went into to cover the American hostage case in Iran when the Ayatollah took the hostages because it had pictures. I mean, I think they're really very mentally lazy.
If you're just joining us, my guest is journalist David Halberstam, and his new book is called The Next Century. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. David Halberstam is my guest. Your book, The Next Century, kind of picks up looking ahead after the American century, after the century where America is the dominant force in the globe.
Yeah, you know, that began with the first Henry Ford. We had cheap oil, and he found a way to do mass production of a car so that the worker became a consumer. And that is the beginning of the American century, much expedited by the fact that twice within 20 years, European nations waged total war upon each other, devastated each other, and out of that vacuum, America became the ascending superpower.
Well, your point is that those days are over.
They are over. They are clearly over.
Do you think that the war we're fighting is based on America being in the American century when we no longer are?
I think there are a lot of other things that I think we have not come to a realization that we are no longer in the American century. I think we are still, I mean, I think we there's a kind of almost political paralysis that refuses to realize that we are no longer in a period of American economic hegemony. And I think one of the interesting things and one of the dangers about the Persian Gulf War, two things about it. One, the very act of the war delays America confronting a much more serious agenda about its own future, about, you know, how well it's going to do, how solid its economy is. I mean, that's the first problem ahead. The second thing is that it seems to me that there's going to be an inclination on the part of our society, many people in it, to say, hey, we're still number one. We are powerful. We are where we ought to be. We're doing well. And not to understand that that quick flash of American military might in the Persian Gulf does not represent grave, serious social and economic problems at home. That it is a thin veneer of military might and does not reflect more grave problems with the society.
So even a great success in the Gulf could serve to just distract us from our real problems.
Well,
of education.
Well, I think it makes us think that we're more powerful than we are. It is, I mean, it's an application of extraordinary technology. I mean, of bombs that are smart and are laser driven and seem to be able to go around buildings and right in the right office and whatever. But what's true is, I mean, and I talk about in the book, I mean, America has diverted so much of its energy because of the Cold War into its military arsenal and so much of its talent into designing weapons. And meanwhile, along come people like the Japanese, and they are diverting the same amount of energy into the consumer economy. And suddenly the Japanese have a very healthy economy and we have a more vulnerable one. I quote in the book a very distinguished Japanologist at Cal San Diego named Chalmers Johnson saying, the Cold War's over, the Japanese won. And I mean, and there's an odd, terrible truth in there.
Well, how do you think the Japanese won?
Well, because, I mean, I mean they haven't really won the Cold War. I mean, that's a bit of a joke.
I get the joke. Yeah.
But I mean, what it really means is that they came in under the American military umbrella. They wasted nothing in defense industry. Their most talented people went right into the consumer industries. And as such, they have done very well because they are unburdened by this factor of a huge defense industry, which sucks at the real resource of a society. I mean, some of it is mandatory. You've got to have a defense industry of some sort. But the clear feeling is, I would think, that it is out of whack, that this society is out of whack in terms of its priorities. I mean, we have bridges and highways that are tearing apart. Our industrial base is being undermined and is eroding. Our governors go almost on bended knee to Japan to get the Japanese to locate factories there. I mean, we're a troubled society. Under the veneer of the success in the Persian Gulf, is of a society that is increasingly a two-tiered society.
Well, you compare the cities to being part first world, part third world.
Yeah, well, they already are. I mean, they're already, I mean, a city I live in New York City is a first world, third world city with less and less middle class. And I think we're in danger of having a declining middle class. One of the points I make in the book, I talk at some length with Lester Thoreau, the quite distinguished economist, Newsweek columnist, and I guess he's the head of the Sloan School at MIT, and we're talking about this because I see that great social fluidity in that broad middle class that I knew in America in the 40s and 50s and now even in the 60s beginning to erode. And he agrees, and he says, you know, when I read in newspapers, I hear Japan referred to as having an establishment, and Latin American countries always referred to as having an oligarchy. An oligarchy, as you know, is a few people who have great economic power but don't share it very much. And he says, you know, does America have an establishment or an oligarchy? And he ponders this question, and he says, well, after World War II, clearly we had an establishment. That is, we had a handful of people who came from an upper class and knew that if America were to be mighty, the wealth had to be shared. You had to open up your universities, your prep schools, your factories, your whatever. And we've had that, and we've had an oligarchy from time to time. The question now, and in the Latin American countries, there really is a small handful of people who think as long as they're doing well, it doesn't matter whether the rest of the society does well. And he says, in comparison, in Japan, I mean, the Japanese, he says, are probably just as selfish as the people who lead that society as any other country. But they know, in a country as crowded as that, for their own children to do well, the children of other ordinary people have to do well. And the question now, he said, is America moving towards an oligarchy? And I think it may well be. I mean, an oligarchy, by the way, in which position is granted by basis of access to elite education. And that, if that happens, you are going to get social dynamite, because you are not only going to get people who are not going to live that well, but they're people whose parents lived better and who themselves can, in their own lifetime, track a declining place in the society.
You know, I think last year when Eastern Europe broke away from the Soviet Union, that it was perceived as the victory of America, of American capitalism in the Cold War. You don't really see it as America's victory.
No, I see it as a great victory for the people who live in those countries, the end of an incompetent Russian Empire, which, and I think Russia is viewed now. I mean, one of the things that you could do in that great moment when it happened was pull aside the curtain, and you could see that Russia was a military superpower, but an utterly incompetent society, economically, socially, and politically, that it was a barely developing society and all other things, that it could not, in the most basic, elemental way, answer the needs of ordinary citizens. You go to Russia, and there's a one McDonald's hamburger shop there, and they have a line six blocks long for it. I mean, you know that's a country that's got problems. It's a country that can't truck a tomato from Georgia to Moscow. As a friend of mine says, the thing the country needs to be run by is Federal Express delivery system. I think the collapse of that empire in Eastern Europe is a great victory for the ordinary people of that society, who held on to a better and different vision of life, for more democratic society, whether it's Valencia in Poland and the Solidarity people and people like Adam Michnik and others, whether it's Havel in Czech. I mean, all those ordinary people who, subjugated by the Soviets, always believed there was a better possibility. It was not a victory for us. I mean, it may be a victory in some ways for the West Europeans and for the West Germans, because they, I think, are going to be the next Japan. They're going to be the economic and perhaps the political beneficiary of these changes. They are going to fill the vacuum that the Soviets have left. But it is not about a victory for capitalism. American capitalism, as it exists now, after a decade of pillaging by people like Milken and Boesky and a lout like Donald Trump, I mean, needs to be much more balanced, much more entrepreneurial, less manipulative, less leveraging, and more invested in really making things. I mean, we have a lot of problems at home. I mean, these great victories come, and we are not in a particular position to be the beneficiary of these events economically. I mean, our heroes of the 80s are a really sad lineup.
Do you feel that we're in a time now when the map of the world in terms of power is about to be completely rewritten?
But I think that's why I called it
the war in the Gulf.
Well, that's why I called it the next century. I mean, I think that all the essential parts of the equation of what we've known for 40 or 50 or even 60 years in this society have changed. The Cold War is over. Russia is unmasked as a limited military power with great economic problems. It is pulled back from Eastern Europe. American economic hegemony is over. We do not automatically make everything better than anybody else in the world. The nature of work has changed, and it has really been changed by the Japanese, who brought a definition of economic power in which it comes from the maximization of the human brain rather than from material resource such as oil.
Where do you see America fitting in the next century?
Well, I have a great long-range faith in the common sense and the pragmatism of the American people. I'm old enough. I'm 56 years old. I lived through World War II, and I watched us go from almost isolationism and the destruction of our Navy and our Army at the time of Pearl Harbor to the enormous superpower success of America at the time of the Battle of Midway. I think it was only 7 months later. I watched us grow out of the Depression. I'm a child of the Depression. I watched us come back from a bad war in Vietnam. I think we are living over our heads and being self-indulgent now and pretending we still have economic hegemony when we don't. But I have a great capacity in the society as being regenerative, of being pragmatic, of American. The ability of American people to reinvent themselves, to be what they want to be, and I think that gives us great assets. I don't see any one nation rising to the replacement of what we were from the 40s to the 80s. I think that's kind of a fluke created really more than anything else by the aftermath of World War II. And I mean, I think that's an unusual and illusory version of power, that one nation would be for a time so rich and powerful when all around it are so weak and pessimistic.
My guest is journalist David Halberstam. More with Halberstam in 60 seconds. This is Fresh Air. Journalist David Halberstam is my guest. He won a Pulitzer Prize for his reporting on the war in Vietnam. His new book is called The Next Century. It's about the end of the American century. You know, you've mentioned in your book how you were always politically informed, but it wasn't until you started writing about Japan in the 1980s that you really had to get an economic grounding.
I was an economic illiterate, like most journalists of my generation.
Well, you know, I think so many people, especially people who came out of the humanities in one way or another, really didn't learn economics very well.
I don't think it's about not learning economics, Terry. I think it is coming to young manhood. I graduated from college in 1955, and that meant that American economic success and strength was a given, and therefore it was never even an issue. The question was really, how do we carve up this pie? And that was the issue. And it wasn't that I was from the humanities. It was that it wasn't an issue. And now it is an issue. Yeah. And that the next generation, the younger people the young journalists in their 30s are much better economic reporters than people like me who are in the mid-50s or people even older.
Well, how do you think you've been changed by learning, by no longer being an economic illiterate?
Well, I think you have a much better capacity to read the politics of this country, because if you read the politics just as an end in itself, you get caught up in effect a dumb minutiae. But if you have a sense of eroding economic underpinnings, then I think you understand the edginess of American politics and why it doesn't face real issues in its quadrennial election and why, you know, it's afraid to, it's uneasy, it's edgy. Issues like the Pledge of Allegiance become the dominant issue, or abortion becomes the issue. I mean, issues that really are much more ancillary to what the American agenda is, and it's because we're afraid to face these realities. Nobody's really going to debate it, and we cover them up with tricky little sound bites, and therefore we postpone the real hard decisions, and we become a nation that continues to live over our heads. And that, I mean, so it's made me, I think, infinitely better a political reporter.
Now, earlier today, you were very critical of how television has covered events over the years.
Over the last 10 years. I think it's the gap between the cumulative news judgment of the major national newspapers and of the networks, I think, has widened all the time.
But I bet you're still pretty addicted to the TV coverage of the war, and that you'll be
going home to your hotel room or apartment or whatever and watching it, right? Yeah.
And you'll be frustrated.
I mean, I watch
as you
every
watch?
Night. I mean, if I can. I mean, that's a natural addiction. It's a compelling event, but it's also only a part of the American agenda. You could You could win this war and not only not do well in this peace, but you could watch an America slowly, systematically erode and become a second-rate society educationally and therefore, in the long run, economically as well. And the networks could easily miss the story. And they're missing the story right now.
David Halberstam, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Journalist David Halberstam, his new book is The Next Century.